Hi, I'm Marco Werman at The World. We've been asking listeners and readers for support as we cover one of the biggest stories of our time. Thank you for the many messages of gratitude and encouragement, and yes, financial support as well. There are many worthy places seeking your help during this pandemic. If you think independent and accurate journalism is part of the solution, now is a good time to show your support for The World. Right now, all contributions will be matched by an anonymous donor who believes in fair, free global reporting. That means your gift of $50 will provide $100 of support for The World's coverage. Our journalism has never been behind a paywall, but it does cost money to bring you these important stories, reported with nuance, context, and voices from the front lines of our interconnected world. We are asking for your support to make sure this essential reporting remains freely available, always, for everyone. We're grateful when you listen to public radio, and especially grateful for your support of The World's nonprofit journalism. And you have a unique opportunity right now to double the impact of your financial support. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. Or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. The European Union not so united around coronavirus. A top EU scientist wanted more collaboration.
We need to all roll up our sleeves and get the job done no matter what we do in our regular lives. Now's the time for an emergency response.
He didn't get it, so he resigned. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the U.S. is continuing to deport people, even though some believe that could help spread COVID-19.
I don't think saying that you're doing a visual inspection or saying that you're doing temperature checks is sufficient. It's negligent.
Meanwhile, young Canadians start a hotline of joy for seniors in their community.
Dial 1 to listen to jokes of the day. Dial 2 to hear today's story. Dial 3 for poems of the day.
And it's not Wisconsin. South Korea tries to keep its election safe in the middle of the pandemic. Those stories and more today on The World. Looking forward to normal, some European countries are easing lockdown restrictions to get their economies and lives back to normal. Here in the U.S., officials are starting to think about what normal might look like. States on the East and West Coast are working together on that, a move that has not sat well with President Trump.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be.
Meanwhile, a moment of humility in France. President Emmanuel Macron said in a speech last night that his country was not prepared for this kind of pandemic.
Quand pourrons-nous renouer avec la vie d'avant?
Macron extended the nationwide lockdown in France until May 11th. After that, some schools and workplaces will gradually reopen.
Le confinement le plus strict doit encore se poursuivre jusqu'au lundi 11 mai.
The news of stricter measures in France comes even as Italy and Austria have decided to let some shops reopen as restrictions there start to lift. It's just one sign of the varied responses to the coronavirus in countries across Europe. Within the European Union, each national government has been planning its own public health response to the pandemic. Top European scientist Mauro Ferrari has argued the bloc should have pursued a more coordinated response. He resigned last week in protest from his post as president of the European Research Council. Professor Ferrari, you wrote in your statement of resignation that you're, quote, extremely disappointed by the European response, end quote, to the pandemic, and that you've lost faith in the system itself. What is the problem with the EU's response in your eyes?
Of course, the response to coronavirus is an extraordinarily complicated, multifaceted problem for everybody, no matter where we are in the world. And science, this is the number one point I want to make, science needs to be the foundation for the response. How do we get the data to make sure that the policy decisions are based on science? It requires very coordinated collaborative programs and sharing of data among different countries, regions, cities, you name it. Now, Europe has done a number of good things. Unfortunately, their ability to share information with each other has been limited.
What has limited that collaboration?
If you look at the reasons for my resignation, of course, this consideration about the public healthcare response was one consideration indeed. And the reason for my resignation was that I thought the European Research Council needed to have a special program dedicated, of course, to the COVID-19 response, discovering the new science frontiers, because we have very limited amount of scientific information about this virus. So I called for a special program dedicated to this that will be very strongly interdisciplinary to come up with true breakthrough solutions. And unfortunately, the proposal for a program was voted down unanimously.
Not only was that suggestion of a scientific program to combat the virus shot down unanimously, the European Research Council also requested your resignation. You also resigned yourself. What was their reasoning, though? I mean, why didn't they want this plan?
The European Research Council prides itself on being the champion organization of what is known as bottom-up science, meaning that rather than specifying what topics are the focus of the various programmatic initiatives, say COVID or poverty, the ERC simply encourages the best of scientists to submit their proposals and then convenes panels of experts to decide which ones are most exciting and most promising. By converse, top-down means that you assign a specific topic and you say, give me your best proposals in this topic. And I was not advocating that that should change. I was just advocating that we should add on top of that some programs that would be top-down on COVID so that this great wealth of scientific excellence could be brought to bear. There is such a huge need for this healthcare crisis, potentially of unprecedented proportions in the history of humankind, that we need to all roll up our sleeves and get the job done no matter what we do in our regular lives. Now is the time for an emergency response.
Do you think it suggests that there is an unwillingness across Europe to collaborate?
The world of science likes collaboration, and that I've seen pretty much everywhere. However, it is true that I think we have seen a bit of a reversal in Europe, and we have seen that really become dramatic at this time of the coronavirus crisis, with countries that have been working on bringing down barriers and borders for all these years, all of a sudden setting up unilateral barrier and border restrictions and travel restrictions against one another. And they say almost a reversal to medieval times in some ways. So I think this time of stress, Europe has reversed to a much less unitary, I think, approach to everything.
Professor Mauro Ferrari is the former president of the European Research Council. He resigned from his post last week in protest. Professor, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
My great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Across the globe, there's an old drug that's getting a lot of new attention, especially here in the U.S.
Chloroquine, and some people would add to it hydroxychloroquine.
President Trump has used numerous press briefings to talk about the drug's potential use in treating the novel coronavirus. It's an unproven claim, the evidence is thin, and amid a massive run and turf wars on the drugs as a result, scientists are rushing to set up trials to catch the research up to the hype. The gap is big, but if you think the race for chloroquine is a new thing, think again. The World's Alana Gordon reports.
Chloroquine is this really bitter-tasting pill that pharmacies have had on hand for decades. It's powerful. The difference between a safe and toxic dose is tiny. But chloroquine's origins and global importance date back to a much earlier pandemic.
There are such clear parallels between what's happening now and what happened in the 17th century when there was a malaria pandemic.
Fiammata Rocco has written a book about the history of malaria and the race for a cure. Italy was at the center of this outbreak. Malaria is an Italian word. Mal aria essentially means bad air. People thought the illness, the shaking chills and spiked fevers, came from noxious fumes, not disease-carrying mosquitoes. In 1623, malaria killed the Pope. The Vatican shut down. 10 of 55 cardinals died. The Jesuits set out on a scientific expedition.
They started to try and find a treatment for it.
One place they looked was the Andean region of South America, to an area that is home to the cinchona plant.
You have to imagine sort of these huge, gigantic sort of botanical creations through which very little light even passes into the ground. They're so huge.
Rohan Debroy is a medical historian at the University of Reading in the UK. He says early on, the missionaries and Spanish conquerors observed how locals used the bark of the plant to treat malarial fevers. How the bark actually worked was a big mystery. But over time, it became clear that having access to this so-called Jesuit cure brought back to Europe meant more than saving the next pope.
Whatever cured malaria should be understood not just as a medicine, but also as a military weapon.
Deb Roy says malaria could kill more soldiers than bullets during war.
And that led to the understanding that the cure for malaria would be then seen as a tool of empire, enabling soldiers to survive in these unpredictable tropical colonial landscapes, which otherwise would be impossible for them.
At first, Spain reigned over the Americas and this cinchona bark. Other industrial powers, the Dutch, the French, and the British, looked for a workaround. By the late 1800s, they were attempting to grow cinchona on their own plantations. Rohan says not all these plants were of the same quality, taste, and type. It was the Dutch who won out. They cultivated the most effective and consistent kind in their territory of Java, or what is present-day Indonesia.
That created considerable political mileage in favor of the Dutch because these other imperial powers were more or less dependent on a Dutch product produced in Dutch plantations.
As colonial governments tried to grow the best bark, scientists tried to figure out what exactly was in it, what compound or alkaloid made it work. Two French researchers found the answer.
The North American audience, it would be quinine. Britain, it is like quinine. And I've also heard the word being pronounced as quinine.
The compound quinine became the basis for many anti-malarial drugs in the years to come. But it would take a whole century of attempts to actually succeed in making synthetic variations. These attempts grew more and more intense as the world went to war in the early 20th century, because malaria posed a threat to all sides, including U.S. soldiers training in the South.
And we often forget now, you know, malaria was all over the place. All up through the Mississippi River Valley, there was malaria.
Leo Slater is a chemist and historian of malaria. The natural version of quinine from the bark was still the essential weapon against the malaria parasite. This became an even bigger problem moving into World War II, when Japan took control of the Dutch East Indies, and with that, those highly coveted cinchona plants.
When they do this, they cut off the rest of the world from the supply of cinchona bark and quinine, just as the war is coming.
By this point, Germany kicked its research into high gear. Its company Bayer took the lead, and Hitler appointed one of the world's top malaria experts to oversee medical research. Drugs were tested on people in state hospitals, prisons, and concentration camps. The U.S. also ramped up its own anti-malarial efforts in a massive way.
Everybody was desperate for another drug.
Karen Masterson is a professor at Stony Brook College and author of a book about the history. She says that in the rush to arm U.S. soldiers with anti-malaria medication, it picked a drug that was incredibly toxic. Soldiers were throwing up everywhere.
They didn't want to take it. They were so resistant to it that the chain of command demanded that their unit commander put the pill in their mouth, close their jaw, and watch their Adam's apple go up and down to swallow it.
By the end of the war, the U.S. realized there was this one drug that worked that appeared to be more tolerable. What was that drug?
And the drug of choice was chloroquine.
Yes, chloroquine. How these quinine molecules actually worked was still a mystery. But by the late 1940s and 50s, chloroquine hit celebrity status across the globe.
Chloroquine becomes one of the miracle drugs.
And the newly formed World Health Organization promoted it.
Chloroquine was going to help people all over the world prevent malaria and get rid of their malaria.
Now, more than 50 years later, chloroquine and its cousin hydroxychloroquine are in the spotlight again as the world now searches for a weapon against this new coronavirus threat. Chloroquine, this product of magic plants, dead popes, and desperate hopes, has again come to represent a glimmer of light for some leaders today. Karen Masterson cautions that it might represent something else, too.
To me, it's a symbol of false hope.
Masterson says even though chloroquine rose to fame fast, its success didn't last long. This so-called miracle drug was pushed out so much that malaria parasites developed a resistance to it. Masterson says this created even more challenges in some communities.
It's not a perfect drug. It's not a magic bullet.
Today, chloroquine still has important medical uses, but it carries serious side effects, and it's deadly for some. Leading scientists are alarmed by the clamor for this drug. And in the fog of a fast-moving pandemic, No one knows yet whether it's actually useful against COVID-19. But what we do know is if you open up chloroquine and examine what's inside, this tiny old pill contains a lot of big lessons about the power of medicine. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're with The World. We know you value what we do here at The World. Right now, during the outbreak of COVID-19, our global coverage is a critical source of information for listeners and readers. Today, we are asking you to support our freely available fact-based reporting. When you support The World, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous donor who, like you, values the important stories, global context, and critical voices we bring you every weekday from the front lines of our interconnected world. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking you to help support it and have your donation matched. Go to theworld.org/give. And don't forget, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous supporter. If you have never contributed to The World before, now is the time to give. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Across the country, the coronavirus outbreak has people in flux. It's also revealing that essential workers like those in warehouses, grocery stores, or transit are more likely to be immigrants and people of color. Washington State is where the coronavirus first took hold in the U.S. Esme Jimenez is a reporter with station KUOW in Seattle and is part of our team following Latino voters this year.
We had our first case of COVID back in January. By the end of February, Governor Inslee of Washington declared a state of emergency as the first patient started passing away. And we've had over 10,000 cases so far. Schools were also completely moved entirely online for the rest of the school year.
Yeah, taking out the numbers, that narrative seems to be very similar to what many other states that also have stay-at-home orders are experiencing. And we also see that many essential workers are still out there on the job, like grocery store workers, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And in Seattle, at least, what I'm seeing is that essential workers are majority Black and brown. I've also been talking to young Latinos in Washington State impacted by all of this who are first-time voters this year. For example, I talked to 17-year-old Michelle Aguilar Ramirez. And Michelle is of Guatemalan descent. We ended up talking over Facebook Messenger to keep social distancing rules. Mm. And one of the first things that sticks out to me is how directly this pandemic affects her now. Michelle's mother works at a clothing warehouse, and she's also undocumented. Here's Michelle talking a little bit more about that.
I'm first generation, and obviously, like, it's hard because my mom is, like, a single mom, and she can barely get ends meet and stuff, even though, like, she works and works and works, and she does overtime, and she still can't figure it out.
As you can hear in Michelle's voice, she's really worried about her mother.
And I can only imagine the pandemic is impacting Michelle's family differently, especially with her mother's undocumented status, right?
So Michelle is a U.S. citizen, but a lot of her family members are not, including her mom. And as we know, undocumented people are going to be hurting in a different way during this time. They can't access Medicaid, for example, so they can't get tested for the virus. They're not getting the stimulus checks that a lot of U.S. citizen families and individuals will be getting, meaning that they could fall behind on rent, bills, or even groceries during this time.
So with all this going on, Esme, in school and work, what is Michelle thinking about the election in November?
She's definitely interested in voting, but as you know, with the pandemic and all the news that's happening, she seemed really overwhelmed. You know, the other thing that she said that surprised me was she was explaining that she feels like her vote doesn't necessarily count in the Northwest.
It's not like I live down in California where, like, the majority of the people are Hispanics and, like, your vote really does, like, make a difference. I feel like, in my opinion, my vote isn't really going to help my community specifically.
Is that Michelle being overwhelmed, or is she right about that?
While the Northwest doesn't have Latinos in numbers like the Southwest or Florida, it is a growing population, especially in rural agricultural areas. And I also want us to remember that for many Latinos, what happens is that they come from parents or families that have lost a lot of hope in politics back in their home country. So they aren't just thinking about current U.S. politics. Young Latino voters like Michelle are grappling with a lack of trust in the system as a whole. So Guatemala, for example, is still dealing with the impacts of a 36-year-old civil war. And for the last year, there's growing gang violence as well. And I hear when Michelle and I talked about this, her family constantly reminds her of that.
So despite all of this, what is motivating her to vote? And does she have an idea of who she'd like to vote for?
Like many Latinos I talked to here in Seattle, she leans Democrat. But when she talked, she was kind of disenchanted with both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden at the time. And now Biden is the only one left. Honestly, I picked up that she just wants something different for her and her family, especially now with the coronavirus pandemic.
That was Esme Jimenez for our Every 30 Seconds project, highlighting the vote of young Latinos in the 2020 election. Esme, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Many countries have blocked international commercial flights, but certain flights are still happening, including one plane that recently left the U.S. for Haiti. The World's Monica Campbell tells us why.
One morning last week, more than 60 people lined up to board a plane in Alexandria, Louisiana. It was leaving for Haiti. And then at the last minute, several people were held back, including one man.
Yeah, I was very surprised because I was just on the line for me to get on the plane. And then
the man who's speaking asked to not reveal his name because he's an undocumented immigrant from Haiti who is being held in a detention center and his case remains uncertain. He expected to be deported to Haiti when he was pulled from the line at the airport. So why the last minute change? Coronavirus.
Yeah, I was very worried. I did come to a lot of facility where
he was worried about a lot of things, going back to a country he left when he was 12 years old and possibly arriving there sick. He's been shuttled through several detention facilities where COVID-19 cases have emerged. That alarmed his lawyer, Ira Alkali.
Since he's already had multiple exposures to areas that have been positive for the coronavirus, it wouldn't be fair to Haiti or to him to put him on a plane where he's potentially carrying the virus.
Alkali, working with U.S. politicians and activists, managed to keep his client off the plane. But the flight did take off, deporting more than 60 immigrants back to Haiti. Francisca Lucien is among the activists trying to stop deportations while the coronavirus is spreading. She's with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti.
Haiti is one of many countries in the region that is facing an uphill battle with this pandemic. There have been other countries, including Guatemala, that recently requested the U.S. to halt deportations.
Guatemala has temporarily refused to accept flights carrying deported immigrants after some passengers tested positive for the virus. But this week, the flights are back on. Haiti's ambassador to the U.S., Herve Denise, is also against these flights.
You know, we are a poor country. We have the fears that this is possibly a possibility that could add to the spread of that virus.
Haiti, he says, has little leverage over the U.S.
This is always the situation. The United States is the greatest country in the world, and you know, this is David and Goliath, so what can we do? And we are not even David.
This is David and Goliath, and you said you're not even David.
We're not even David.
U.S. officials didn't grant an interview, but they've stated that enforcement must continue, pandemic or not. Also, President Trump threatens visa sanctions against countries that refuse to accept deported immigrants. Immigration officials also say they're following health protocols, including taking the temperature of immigrants before they board planes. But that's not enough, says Mark Julmis, a chief nurse at a hospital in Haiti, who also works with the global nonprofit Partners in Health.
I don't think saying that you're doing a visual inspection or saying that you're doing temperature checks is sufficient. It's negligent. That's a very basic primary screening, very basic primary screening.
Julmis is relieved that so far, Haiti has only about 40 confirmed COVID-19 cases, compared to more than 580,000 in the U.S. She hopes the numbers stay low and worries that people coming in from U.S. detention centers could drive those numbers up. The Haitian immigrant I spoke with worries he could be one of those people. For now, he remains in detention. He sleeps in a room with 24 other men in bunk beds placed 3 feet apart, he says.
Like, we clean every spot. I think we, like, clean the bathroom, make sure the room's clean, you know, spray everything, you know.
He says he cleans everything using whatever bits of soap he can get. He also knows that the U.S. is continuing to deport people and that more flights to Haiti will be scheduled soon. It's unclear whether or not he'll be forced to board the next plane heading out. For The World, Monica Campbell.
News headlines are coming up next. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Scammers online are impersonating public health agencies.
It is the absolute perfect scenario for a criminal group to prey on the public, and that's what we're seeing around the world.
Meanwhile, cyber experts are volunteering to stop them.
We were blown away by the response.
Cybersecurity in a pandemic. That's next here on The World. Think before you click. It's one of the basic rules of cybersecurity, and one that governments and experts around the world are finding themselves having to repeat these days. That's amid an uptick in scams and cyber attacks using the pandemic as bait, trying to get us to click. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports.
Luke Finlay Douglas is a 28-year-old copywriter in London. Like many of us, he's been holed up in his apartment for weeks now.
Luckily, I've got some lovely housemates and the cats, so, like, it could be worse.
The other night, Douglas was checking his email, this old Hotmail account he still uses, when a message with a catchy subject line came through.
It just comes up with, "Sorry, Finlay Douglas, I see you have COVID-19. I'm just like, one, what is going on here? Two, I'm absolutely going to check this out because this sounds ridiculous."
To be clear, Douglas doesn't have COVID-19. He does have a habit of checking out spam that makes it in his mailbox because he says it's often entertaining. So he decided to open the message. It was from a woman who goes by Medium Amanda. "Dear first name," the email starts.
"Your energy came to me in a beautiful vision." I just started laughing. I was like, okay, this is pretty good.
In this email, Medium Amanda promises to change Douglas's fate and to increase his cash flow. All he has to do is get in touch with her within 5 days by clicking a blue banner at the bottom of the email that read,
"Click here to get in touch with Medium Amanda immediately."
Douglas decided to stay away from the links.
I haven't clicked them, obviously, because why would you do that?
He was worried about what's known as phishing, clicking a link that would download malware on his computer and give hackers access to his personal information, like passwords, bank account, and credit card numbers. He had good reason to be worried. Experts say cyber criminals are increasingly using COVID-19 as a lure to trick people into clicking fishy links that open them up to cyber attacks.
COVID-19 is an amazing lure.
Mike Santonis is the chief technology officer at CrowdStrike, a cybersecurity company based in California, though Santonis works from Sydney, Australia. He says cyber attackers and criminals see significant global events like this pandemic as business opportunities.
There's so much concern and people who are trying to get information about what's going on.
So they're more likely to click on things they would normally ignore. And then there's the fact that so many are working from home, often without the technical support and defense systems they'd get at work.
So it is the absolute perfect scenario for a criminal group to prey on the public. And that's what we're seeing around the world.
The types of scams that Santonis and his company have been tracking are a bit more devious and a lot less obvious than emails from the Medium Amandas of the world. They're messages purporting to be from the World Health Organization or the Centers for Disease Control, from company executives announcing mass layoffs, from doctors who claim to have found a cure for the virus. The common denominator in these phishing emails and texts is COVID-19, but the bait is often tailored to appeal to whatever population is being targeted.
In Australia, we see examples of fake emails and things talking about what the government is doing or financial aid packages. That's really common.
Here in the U.S., when the government approved an economic stimulus package, people started receiving phishing texts saying, "Click on this link and you'll get your government assistance." Santona says cyber criminals will target individuals with the goal of infiltrating the organizations they belong to. The motive behind these attacks is often financial. Criminals want to steal your money. But there's often another motive, espionage.
I'd be concerned today if I was a pharmaceutical company that's doing research, because there'll be a lot of people that would be eager to get access to that research.
The people going after information like that are often state-linked hackers, according to the cybersecurity company FireEye. Sandra Joyce is the head of global intelligence there. She says groups with links to the Chinese, North Korean, and Russian governments have been going after organizations in all sorts of industries in order to spy on them.
In some cases, we have very strong links to the official government entity, and in some cases, threat actors appear to be working on their behalf.
And while espionage is concerning, what Joyce and other researchers are most worried about right now are the types of attacks that could bring critical organizations like hospitals to a standstill. A hacker could get into a hospital system and essentially hold it hostage until they get a payout.
So I would say that if you are in those types of organizations, it is even more critical now to not click on strange links, to think twice when you're opening up an attachment.
To double-check the email address or number a message is coming from. And for goodness sake, to just stay away from those tempting emails from Medium Amanda. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Not clicking is a great start when it comes to combating cyber threats. Cybersecurity experts can do much more. Specifically, I'm thinking of what the new COVID-19 Cyber Threat Intelligence League is able to do. It's a group of over 1,000 cybersecurity experts from around the world volunteering their time to help fend off attacks. Mark Rogers is the VP of Cybersecurity Strategy for Okta. He's also one of the managers of the project. I asked him how the group got started.
Well, it was a group of us, friends and colleagues of mine, and we were thinking, there's a lot of security people sitting around not doing a lot in their evenings. No social time, we just tend to kind of do security time. And so we went to see if we could pull that group together and see what the appetite was. And we were blown away by the response. We're actually knocking on about 1,400 people now. We have members from 40 different countries. So we cover almost every single time zone. And people have just been absolutely willing to come forward and do what they can to help protect those who are defending us and who are at the front line of this fight by ensuring that malware doesn't cause a problem or disrupt their operations.
Walk us through one incident. Like, how does the process work when volunteers from the COVID-19 CTI League step in and respond?
Sure. So probably the easiest one to talk through is either a malware or a phishing campaign. We'll get indicators. We've got tools that we've set up that automatically scan for these things publicly. We also have people submitting information. We then tear it apart, look at how it works, try to understand the structure of the campaign. And then we find domains which are called indicators of compromise, or we find other links that take us onto other parts of their infrastructure. And then we work to dismantle it. We work to get the domains pulled down. We work to identify other campaigns they're doing and take those down. We have taken down hundreds of domains. We've dismantled a significant number of campaigns. We're just using the same techniques that we use during our day jobs. The only difference is because we're all together and we're all so much closer, we can do this really fast. Instead of having to send an email that has to go over several country boundaries, we can just say, hey, you, we've got a bad thing on your registrar. Here's the information. What do you want to do? And they go, yep, we agree it's bad. We're going to take it down. And so we're able to kill things in a matter of hours that under normal practice would probably take us days or even weeks.
In the cases that the COVID-19 CTI League has responded to, does law enforcement take over at some point?
Yes. If there's anything that's out of our reach or if we think it's above our pay grade, we push it up to law enforcement. We're very keen that we follow a responsible process. We don't want to step on potentially active cases that they may be working on. So very early on, we got deep engagement with law enforcement. They're on the site with us, helping us. We have law enforcement from all over the world. Like, I think it might be up to 20 different countries all over the world who've all come and joined. And there's no hint of, you know, territorial concern or what are you guys doing? It's just literally, how can we help?
I got to say, your take on the cooperation is really encouraging. Do you think it's going to continue past the pandemic?
I really do hope so. This has been a big discussion I've been having with some of our law enforcement partners and with my co-founders. Every time there's a major event worldwide, there is a major upswing in cybercrime. We would love to see a group like this continue. So there was a major upswing in defense. That would be phenomenal. We would make the internet a much safer place.
Mark Rogers, the VP of Cybersecurity Strategy for Okta and one of the managers of the COVID-19 CTI League. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
January 20th, the U.S. recorded its first case of COVID-19. It so happens South Korea recorded its first case that same day, and yet South Korea has managed to contain the virus to just 10,000 infections and 200 deaths. Compare that to more than 24,000 deaths here in the U.S. Koreans are also trying to carry out their civic duty. One of the many thumping campaign songs for tomorrow's parliamentary election. Despite the pandemic, early voting in South Korea took place last week. Tomorrow is the main event. Reporter Jason Strother is in Seoul, and I asked him first how bad the situation is with the virus in South Korea.
It's not back to a complete normality, but if you just walk around here on the streets of Seoul, you wouldn't think that a whole lot has changed. You can still go out to a restaurant. You can still go to the movie theater. Subway cars are packed. Buses are still packed. Life is going on here despite the social distancing orders that are in place until the beginning of next week.
Even in the midst of this pandemic, this election in South Korea continues as scheduled. South Korea's National Election Commission has been working really overtime to get new rules up and running to allow safe voting. So how's that going to happen? How will voting actually be taking place?
Right, Marco. Well, there have already been kind of dress rehearsals for the Wednesday. At the end of last week, there were 2 days of early voting. A record number of voters came out, somewhere around 12 million South Koreans, like 27% of the electorate cast ballots on those two early voting days. And I spoke to one of those voters. Her name is Hannah Yoon. She's 32, a writer, lives here in Seoul. And she told me how the whole process went down at the polling station.
I don't know if a mask was mandatory because I was already wearing one. And they handed out gloves and hand sanitizer. And they took your temperature before you went up the stairs, because my voting booth was on the second floor. And you had to put on the gloves before you got your voting paper. And then you had to take off the gloves as soon as you were leaving.
I mean, it's really a contrast, isn't it, to the challenges we saw recently in Wisconsin. A seeming lack of social distancing, discarded ballots. And there's no system of mail-in ballots in South Korea? It's all in person?
No, South Korea does not have a mail-in ballot system. So if you want to vote, you have to show up at one of these polling stations. And speaking of Wisconsin, that was also on the mind of voter Hannah Yoon. She had some comparisons to draw.
I didn't feel like it was super safe here, but at the same time, looking at like how Wisconsin handled their primaries and just seeing pictures of people online without masks did make me feel a little bit better about voting here in Seoul.
Jason, I'm wondering about people in South Korea who are sick and quarantined. Is there a plan for allowing them to vote?
During the 2 days of early voting, kind of makeshift polling stations were set up in some of the medical facilities where the coronavirus patients are staying. So those who were well enough to vote could cast a ballot. As for the 50,000 or so people that are in self-quarantine right now, special provisions are being made for them to leave their house once the polls close at 6 p.m. on Wednesday here. They will be allowed to vote, but then right after they cast their ballots, they have to get back home by 7 p.m.
So politically, how much of an issue is the coronavirus? Who stands to gain? Who stands to lose from this?
We've seen President Moon Jae-in's popularity rise over the past month or so. His party was doing fairly well even before the pandemic struck, although some analysts felt that the elections could have gone either way. But now, after he has won all this acclaim from around the world about how South Korea has been able to mitigate the coronavirus, it certainly is benefiting him as well as his party. I spoke to a Korea analyst at the Shorenstein Center at Stanford, Jiuk Shin, who told me that even though the president has shown that he has done a good job at confronting COVID-19, there are still some other things that he has not shown his expertise at.
In other words, the government may have been quite successful in containing the virus, but it doesn't mean that they've been successful in dealing with economic situation.
I'm just curious how much of the economy in South Korea has been really affected by the virus, and could that be a liability for Moon Jae-in?
As far as the economic toll here during the pandemic, statistics from the government show that unemployment claims rose sharply in March. There's also a low in new jobs being created. But one economic research institute here in Seoul says, you know, despite all of that, the economy could be somewhat back to normal as early as next month.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Marco. Stay safe.
In your mind, elections here may feel like they're about 1,000 years away. Israel held a national election last month, the third one in less than a year, and still politicians are scrambling to form a government. A fourth election could be coming soon. In the meantime, one thing that's become clear is the electoral power of Israel's ethnic Arab voters. They came out to the polls in big numbers and cast their votes mostly for Arab politicians. But still, Arab Israelis are looking at the possibility that their Israeli citizenship could be taken away from them with Washington's blessing. The World's Ariel Osoran has our story.
Buried deep in President Trump's peace plan for Israelis and Palestinians is a short paragraph that could have a huge impact on Jamal Mojadla. Mojadla grew up in a town called Baka el-Gharbiya. It's part of a cluster of Arab towns and villages that Israelis call the Triangle. It's sort of the national heartland for Israel's Arab citizens. But if that part of Trump's peace plan is implemented, people like Jamal Mojadla, along with 350,000 others, could all lose their Israeli citizenship. They would not have to be relocated, but they would become citizens of the Palestinian Authority.
I don't want to go to the Palestinian Authority to be no future.
Mojadla comes from a prominent family. He served as interim mayor of Baka al-Gharbiya. His hometown could hardly be any closer to the Palestinian-majority West Bank. It sits right next to the tall concrete wall that divides this part of Israel proper from the Palestinian territory. But Mojadla does not see a great place for himself in a future Palestinian state.
I will stay here and want to stay here because I born here and father and grandfather. I don't move to another state.
More than a decade ago, his brother Ghaleb became the first ever Arab minister in an Israeli government. But today, Mojadla says, he can't imagine that happening.
All of them don't want us to be part of the coalition or the government or to give our rights like the Jewish people.
Mojadla takes me to a place called Falafel on the Fence. It's a popular lunch spot for Arabs and Jewish Israelis. Waiting in line for a stuffed pita, I meet Muhammad. He's 19 years old and works at a friend's family bakery in town. Muhammad tells me he identifies as both an Israeli and as a Palestinian. But he says that Arabs living in Israel face a lot of discrimination. There's racism, Muhammad tells me in flawless Hebrew. But the way to overcome it, he says, is to include Arabs in life here. To live together. That's what will make peace. The Arab citizens of Israel are the largest minority in the country. But before the Trump administration issued its peace plan, the Israeli government passed a so-called nation-state law. Critics say it favors Jewish identity and essentially makes Arabs second-class citizens.
I see this plan as it's a continuation of the nation-state law.
That's Rinaj Barra. She's a lawyer and the head of a nonprofit called Tishrin that works with Arab youth in Taibe, another town in the Triangle.
I see it as a prioritization for Jewish character of the state of Israel. So how can it be a Jewish state with democratic values? It's a contradiction.
Jbara is married to an Israeli lawyer. They settled in his hometown of Taibe, where they're raising their four kids, who all have Israeli citizenship. But not Jbara. She's not a citizen because she was born in the West Bank. As for Trump's peace plan, she says it undermines the two-state solution, which is still seen by most of the world as the best way to resolve the conflict. That's an idea 29-year-old Asil Matani relates to as well. She's a project manager at the same nonprofit.
First of all, I don't say I'm Arab-Israeli. I'm
Arab Palestinian that live in Israel.
Matani has a good job, lives in a nice town, but says that life in Israel as an Arab, and especially one who self-identifies as Palestinian, is not easy.
You feel you are strange in your homeland, you know, that feeling like a stranger in your homeland.
Matani says sure she would like to live in an independent Palestinian state one day, but she says that's not what the Israeli government wants, and it's not what the Trump White House is proposing either.
For me, I believe in one state solution, secular and not Jewish state, for all the people without settlements and the right of return for the Palestinian refugees.
When most Jewish Israelis hear that sort of thing, they think game over, no more Jewish state. Back in Baka el-Gharbiya, I meet Judah Masalha at a little cafe. He's a 14-year-old student here with his dad for lunch. When I ask them about the Trump peace plan, Masalha says something quite striking. He doesn't want to give up his Israeli citizenship, he says. He likes the idea of a future state of Palestine, but at the same time...
I think that the conditions in Palestine are really bad. And because of that, I may choose Israel, not because I love Israel, but because why would I suffer like the other Palestinians? And if I stay in Israel, maybe I could help the Palestinian people more.
The Trump administration's vision for Masalha and his neighbors says that people here in the Triangle, quote, self-identify as Palestinian. There's some truth to that, but many people I speak with say there's no contradiction with identifying as Palestinian and being an Israeli citizen, too. They say before Israel can make peace with the Palestinians, it first needs to make peace within itself. For the world, I'm Ariel Osran, Baka el-Gharbiya, Israel.
In these challenging times, sometimes you just need a pick-me-up, and fast. In the city of Calgary in Western Canada, residents literally have joy on speed dial.
Hi, and thank you for calling Joy for All. We know that isolation is difficult, and we want to keep you company through these challenging times with the voices of children and youth from your community.
The Joy for All hotline is a project from local high school students. They started it specifically for seniors who feel lonely while practicing social distancing. But anyone can call in for free to listen to messages they've recorded.
Dial 1 to listen to jokes of the day. Dial 2 to hear today's stories. Dial 3 for poems of the day. Dial 4 for the daily dose of kindness.
Daily dose of kindness. That sounds nice. Let's dial 4.
Remember a time where you felt really grateful for a special moment in your life. It could be with your family, with your friends, with a pet, or in nature. Let your heart feel that feeling like the warmth of the sun is shining on it, as though your entire body is being wrapped in a warm, cozy blanket.
A warm, cozy blanket, and a daily dose of joy on speed dial. We'll dispense more wisdom and, of course, more news tomorrow on the show. You stay safe, stay healthy. From the Nana Bill Harris Studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.